Live from the Findlay Toyota Studios, it's Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Hey, here we go. 5 o'clock hour. Miles Simmons coming up in just a second for Football Talk. Adam Hill is here. So that bet I was talking about, because we make bets on the show all the time, we don't pay them off, and we've got a whole chart of bets that are not paid off. So I mentioned one that was from 23, 24. The wildest bet I've heard, well, there's a lot of wild bets, but nerdy sports bets. Friends of mine made a Carlos Delgado over under 400 home runs for his career in like the fourth year of his career. That's potentially like a 15-year bet. They both lived, so success, and Carlos Delgado made it to the end of his career. I think he got 400. I don't know who won the bet, though.
It's pretty long term.
It's a little too long, especially at this age. I can't make bets that go 14 years. I just don't see that. Getting the payoff, it seems risky.
It's excessive.
It's excessive. All right, Miles, what's going on, buddy? We got a lot to get into. Justin Raidersville. Adam, can you tee us up here with Miles? And who were some of the new names that were added to the list? I gave you a list of about five there on the rundown.
I mean, obviously the most exciting is Davis Webb.
That one is that is interesting, though.
Of course. I mean, it's an off-the-radar name, for sure.
I think it's interesting, and, you know, it sort of in some ways reminds me of Sean McVay, when Sean McVay, you know, started with the Rams and had all that stuff happen. Because apparently Davis Webb is only, like, a couple weeks older or younger than what Sean McVay was when he got hired. And Sean McVay got hired, like, very, very quickly in that cycle, as I remember, because I was working for the Rams at that time. So, like, what Marshall Faulk said at that time and what has stuck with me about Sean McVay, especially as he's been successful, is you'd rather get a guy a year early and have him and let him grow and maybe make some mistakes and learn on the job than wait because you think he doesn't have enough experience or whatever. And then you're a year late and you don't get him and somebody else does. And oh my gosh, he's like one of the greatest things since sliced bread. Like it obviously it worked out for the Rams, right? It didn't work out for the Raiders with Lane Kiffin, for instance. But I feel like that is more of a Lane Kiffin issue than it is like a youth issue. So I think Davis Webb is intriguing as long as you pair him with a strong defensive coordinator, which they would have to do.
What about Sean McVay's closest friend and confidant, apparently, Chris Shula.
Me?
No, oh. Chris Shula. Is it too? I think it's about right time for him.
Yeah, no, I think it would be about the right time. Look, Chris Shula got to Los Angeles literally with Sean McVay, right? Like those two guys have been as thick as thieves for a very long time. And, you know, Sean McVay didn't just hand over the defensive coordinator role. Like it went to Wade Phillips at first, right? And that's where, like I said, with Davis Webb, you got to have that strong defensive coordinator, because when I first heard, oh, the Rams may hire a 30-year-old who's going to turn 31 in a couple weeks, my first thought was, are you serious? And then it was, well, he's going to bring Wade Phillips. And then you're like, oh, well, that sounds pretty good, actually. And so, like, yeah. I don't remember what the question was. I'm sorry.
Chris Shula, it's his time.
Oh, yes. So, wait, that's why I brought up Wade Phillips. Yeah. Wade Phillips was the first DC. Then Brandon Staley, then Raheem Morris, and then it was Chris Shula. So he had to wait because he was on the Rams staff all that time. And I think he's done a nice job, you know, especially over the last couple of years, where that was one of the lowest paid defensive units in the league. You haven't had Aaron Donald for the last 2 years, and yet they've still, you know, they won the NFC West last year. They still got 12 wins this year. Like that's still, and they're still one of the favorites to win the Super Bowl. So yeah, it could be Chris Shula's time.
It sounded like you were starting off there very negative against him.
Why?
Like,
no.
I don't know. I mean, he had to wait his turn and, you know, he wasn't the guy.
I mean that in the sense that he was young. And whenever you hear the name Shula, right, and he is related to the great Don Shula, you're going to think, oh my gosh, nepotism. And like, to an extent, yes. But also, no, because he was an assistant linebackers coach and then worked his way up and up and up. And so it's not like this is an all of a sudden thing, oh, because he's next to Sean McVay. Like, he's earned his way in this thing. So that's why I'm like, and it's not just been one fluke year. It's been 2 years now of him doing a really good job.
So there are a couple young names on the list, of course. But we know what the Raiders prefer in hiring a coach. We saw this brain trust last year with Tom Brady, the direction they went. I'm thinking, why not Marv Levy? I looked, he is still alive. To be 101.
I mean, it's too bad Bud Grant, you know, is passed on, right?
You think not?
I mean, where are you going with this, Adam?
We know what this brain trust of the Raiders likes in a head coach. I think we can rule out some of the younger guys.
Okay, well, I mean, if we really want to do that, obviously the choice that Brady wanted was Ben Johnson, and that has been very well reported, and you know, throughout the last year, and especially in the last few weeks, now that, oh, look, Ben Johnson is in the playoffs, and look how right Tom Brady would have been, which is the implication, of course, of all these things that are coming out about Brady and Ben Johnson and all this. So, I mean, like, if you want the young, hot coordinator, I mean, I guess it's Clint Kubiak. But Clint Kubiak is more likely than not going to have options. So, if that's the case, are the Raiders the top choice? I don't know.
Don Coryell died in 2010. That's sad.
Miles Simmons is with us, ESPN Las Vegas.
To get Bill Walsh out the grave.
I try to move along here. I like Miles' line. Like, Adam, where are you going with this? I don't say that on the air. I just think it all the time. And I'm like, okay, do I let it happen or not? So we let it happen. So Don Coryell popped there. That was good.
Bill Walsh died in 2007.
We kind of buried the lead candidate for everyone. Let's start with what happened in Baltimore, because you know we've gone back and forth. Last week we did it on Lamar Jackson, and I view this as, and I know they're saying, hey, it's Monken. It was a battle over Monken, the OC. But I view this as, hey, Harbaugh lost the battle, and the organization's like, we can get a coach. We can't get another Lamar Jackson.
I don't know if from what I've been reading through the tea leaves, it almost seems to me like this is Steve Bisciotti more than it is the Ravens organization. Because I would bet, and Eric DaCosta hasn't said anything about this yet, he's not, the statement that came from the Ravens came directly from Steve Bisciotti, right? It was not from general manager Eric DaCosta. And I would bet that Eric DaCosta is probably not thrilled that he, in some ways, unexpectedly has to conduct a coaching search now. And I think in that building, they probably thought, yeah, we're going to be stable. This is fine. But if you are owner Steve Bisciotti and you have a two-time, could have, maybe should have been three-time MVP quarterback, are you going to side with that guy who is more likely to help get you a championship in the next, you know, 3 to 5 years, let's call it, or a 63-year-old coach who has only gotten you once to the AFC Championship game since winning the Super Bowl in 2012. I mean, that, I think, is the way that Bisciotti thought of it. I'm not reporting that. It would make sense to me. And if it's that, and you are so staunchly saying, hey, we need to keep this guy who is the offensive coordinator, that effectively you even criticized because we didn't get Derrick Henry back on the field against the Patriots when we were up in the fourth quarter, and then we lost that game because we didn't do ball control. Like, yeah, I get why Bisciotti would say, no, we're not doing this. We need to make a move. And if you don't like the direction, then that's okay. It's my team, and we're going to go forward. That is, to me, reading the tea leaves, what I think happened.
Harbaugh's definitely coaching right away because he's not going to take a year off.
It doesn't seem like it. I mean, you know, he could if he really wanted to, but there are some decently desirable jobs out there. I mean, the Giants job to me is pretty desirable. I don't know how much people want to work with Joe Shane or not. I think Harbaugh has the resume, let's call it, to come in and say, I don't like that guy. bring me someone from the Ravens organization that I already know, and then they can run my personnel. I think he has the cachet to be able to do that. Because if you look at the Giants, I mean, that's a situation where, especially with their defensive line, and, you know, they got talented players on offense. Unfortunately, they got hurt this year with Malik Nabers, Scataboo, Jackson Dart showed some decent things. You bring in guys who are competent and can coach those guys up. There's no reason why the Giants can't be competitive, I don't think, in 2026. So that, to me, is why that's such an attractive job. And, I mean, you can look at Atlanta as well in a lot of ways. You know, I know Matt Ryan doesn't have that job that was specifically created for him, but they're still interviewing people for it because they basically have to interview people because you can't just not hire somebody out of, you know, the blue in order to do something like that. But, like, they're another team that has some pieces, right? I mean, between, I don't know, the Bijan Robinson, and they got to make a decision on Kyle Pitts, but Drake London is there. Mooney, I mean, they got pieces on defense now too. So I think those two places are desirable enough that if they went hard after Harbaugh and are like, we will make you as high paid coach as you want, like, I don't see why Harbaugh wouldn't keep coaching.
On the Baltimore side, you know, we talk about how this came to fruition. It seems like that's the kind of situation they wouldn't have gotten rid of Harbaugh if they didn't have the replacement ready. I mean, that's how I would feel. And in that case, it would have to be Jesse Minter, right?
Jesse Minter or Anthony Weaver, I think, would be the two guys. Because Weaver, who is the Miami Dolphins defensive coordinator, was a Baltimore Ravens second-round pick. Right, back, I think, in either 2002, 2003. I can't remember exactly the year. But in the early 2000s, played 4 or 5 years for him, then finished his career with the Texans. Was a good player, very highly respected in that building, had coached in that building as well in the last couple of years before then going to Miami and being defensive coordinator in 2024. And Minter is another guy, yes, that was in that building and then went to coach with Jim Harbaugh, the other Harbaugh. So, and he effectively seems a little bit more ready-made to be the head coach, at least from the scheme standpoint, because I think he's done a really nice job with the Chargers defense. I mean, I saw a couple games of theirs this year, and there were some times where he really had some quarterbacks in hell. So if that's the kind of thing that you want, and you want somebody that's familiar to you, then yes, I think that those two would be the front runners, at least in my mind, for what the Ravens need.
Miles Simmons with us. Pro Football Talk here on this Wednesday. It's Cofield and Company. It's ESPN Las Vegas. More on candidates. Florio and others got us hot and heavy early in the week. It's already Wednesday, right? Way early in the week. It was just every day. It's like stuff's developing. But we got fired up about, some of us, about Flores Daboll combination. Uh-huh. Brian Flores is a really interesting case. While I love the kind of the whole villain, I'm going to do what I want thing, you know, screw the NFL, screw Goodell. I saw Jason Cole, who's, you know, pretty good, you know, longtime NFL guy, say, I'd be shocked if the whatever team considered Flores given the lengthy history of stories of Flores backstabbing fellow employees. Excellent coach, not good in management role. What do we hear? And I want to hear Adam on this too. What do we hear, Miles, on Brian Flores?
Well, it depends, because as an assistant, and over the last few years, first with Pittsburgh and then with Minnesota, he gets great marks. I mean, and potentially that is because he is in an assistant role. Now, the other thing is, and this clip has been floating around Twitter for the last day or two when it comes to Brian Flores, you got Ryan Fitzpatrick, who I think was on his own podcast, and he said this a while ago, I remember this when it first came out, that the thing that concerns him with Brian Flores is that, you know, early on in his tenure, he was a little dictatorial, and then he became more open. He became more approachable, somebody who was a little bit more friendly. But then, you know, as time went on, he went back into those, let's call them bad habits, right? If you want to say it that way, where it's, you know, my way or the highway, he's, you know, just not as pleasant, I guess you would say, to be around.
And, well, so he called him a dictator.
Yes, yes, yeah, a dictator. And you know, when you have something like that and you're a head coach, it either works or it doesn't. It works if you're Belichick and you win. It doesn't work if you don't win. And, you know, there's an argument to be made that Brian Flores did some winning in Miami mm-hmm. under some circumstances that were not ideal. Obviously, you know, when in Tankgate, where he was supposed to be, you know, doing whatever he was doing, and Stephen Ross claims he was joking, and then they kept winning anyway. But I think that, you know, when you're with a young Tua Tagovailoa and you don't believe in him and yet you're still winning some games, like, that says something to me about what he's done. And I think the job he's done with the Vikings over the last couple of years merits consideration if you can get him to talk about what he thinks went wrong in an interview and how he would put in guardrails, whether it's, you know, guys on staff or, you know, whatever he needs to do to make sure that those kinds of dictator things don't happen again.
A couple things on this.
Okay. Oh, boy.
Brian Flores. So I think the Raiders have made some mistakes of, oh, this didn't work last time, so let's not do that. Like, or we should have done this last time, so let's change it. And, you know, Bisaccia not getting the job, which I still don't think he should have, but because he didn't get it, they did give it to Antonio Pierce, who shouldn't.
Yes.
Brian Flores that we're talking about right now sounds a lot to me, even though it's different. Sounds a lot like Josh McDaniels.
I hear you.
Of, hey, he had a chance, it didn't quite work out, but here's why, and this is why it's going to be different this time. oh no, that guy's just a really good coordinator. And I don't know that you can that it's fair to do that, but like there is a recent history of having somebody similar in that regard. Also, my personal belief, as people know that listen to this show, like the fact that he wasn't able to tank disqualifies him from me.
Oh my
like,
God.
He should have been losing games at that time.
Oh,
he wasn't. I'm out.
Okay. I hear you on that, the first point. Let me be clear. Because I think whenever you do kind of not do something and you do the opposite or whatever, and the Belichick tree has not been good, right? Like, at all. I saw somebody, I don't even remember where I saw this, but it said something like, oh, maybe Matt Patricia's going to get another chance. I'm like, for what?
Steve would
like,
not be happy.
Are you out of your mind? Like, that doesn't make any sense. And Josh McDaniels had earned, I think, the second chance. And it had been a long time since he had been the head coach. He had been with New England and da-da-da-da-da. I think even though those two come from the same tree, the trunk, they're two different branches. And we don't know how one is going to react to the other. I would just say that I think Brian Flores probably has several more wins, potentially more wins than Josh McDaniels, even though Josh McDaniels has been in two different places, right? I mean, like that.
Yeah.
So I think that there is something to Brian Flores potentially getting a second chance, and we'll see if it works or it doesn't. Most of these coaches are going to fail, right? I mean, that's just the way it is. So I don't know. You got to try something. Got to throw money at it and see what sticks. Mark Davis has been shown he's willing to do that, but I don't know. They just aren't choosing the right people right now.
Miles A. Simmons up on Twitter, Pro Football Talk. You can see him on Peacock as well. With that new feature, don't turn. I don't think you can turn off the show, right? That whole announcer thing on the games, I think they're offering anyway. I try to make a smart remark. I don't know what I'm talking about. Miles, thank you.
I got it.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's an inside joke, but it's for like the three of us. No one else gets it.
That's okay.
Yeah. Radio 101. Someday I'll learn how to do this show. See you, buddy.
Oh, well, I'm done. Okay,
yeah,
bye.
You're done. See you, man. Miles is like, I don't think you're
going to laugh at Steve's joke. You're out.
Oh no! We're very much up against it. So sorry. Sometimes we get a little time tied. Adam had to get in his comments about Don Coryell. That was good stuff.
Now back to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
All right, rolling on in this 5 o'clock hour. We are headed towards another edition of the Josh Pastner Radio Show. Last night, Rebels on the road. I was courtside. That was not pretty. In fact, I think that was worse than some of the upset losses against conferences below the Rebels, like the loss to Montana or the loss to Tennessee State. The margin was an issue. I can't even remember what the score was in the Alabama game. I think that actually in the end might have been a little bit bigger, but it was the competition. I'm not saying Wyoming's bad, but they're a middle-of-the-road team in the Mountain West Conference, which may be what UNLV can only strive to. We're going to get some answers here the next couple of games. First of all, the way they bounce back against Colorado State, and that game's already up. Like, they travel tomorrow in a quick turnaround and go right to Fort Collins. That's going to be a hostile environment. And then they have got Boise here, and Boise, and by the way, CSU and Boise are not up to the starts they wanted to get off to. Now, they've played good schedules, but both of those teams are going to be freaking mad as hell. Max motivated going in, and I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time here because, you know what, we're better doing it face-to-face with Josh Pastner. So I'll be on the Josh Pastner Radio Show. Matt Neverett will be there, and Coach Pastner is pretty open about what's going on here, and we'll get into some of the issues. But last night, they get off to a bad start. They didn't do basically what they should have done from an advantage standpoint. One, they were the bigger team. They didn't get the ball inside often enough early. And then when they did, they couldn't make anything around the rim. And I had said before in talking about keys to the game that Wyoming's small. They have a couple of big guys who came off the bench, actually, who I think showed some promise, but they're not more than like 12-minute-a-night guys. So they mostly have like 6'1 to 6'7. They're all small forwards and guards. And UNLV's bigger. And sometimes in games when it's a lot of times, in games where it's big team versus small team, someone will get to dictate what lineup is going to be on the floor, and the three big lineup for UNLV was not working defensively. So they had to go small, And then, frankly, I didn't think – I don't like questioning effort. I'll say execution on defense wasn't there. This kid, Leland Walker, they couldn't keep him out of the lane. He turned the corner, you know, beat guys off the dribble, and then once that happens, he passes it. You get a second or third pass off of that, and someone's wide open, and they started off 8 of 11 from 3. So it was just a freaking total mess. Make sure you're checking UNLV All Access at Steve Cofield, at ESPN Las Vegas for Rebel basketball coverage, but of course Rebel football coverage, because this time is very busy with the transfer portal. If you didn't see it yesterday, Anthony Calandria out officially. I haven't seen the reported number. I heard it was pretty high that Nebraska gave him. So compared to what UNLV was offering him, he made out. So it worked out. Sometimes guys go and they don't get the money they think they're going to get, but his agents, I think, repped the situation correctly to Calandria. He's going to the Big Ten. I think he'll be fine there as long as he doesn't get injured. But he's going to be at Nebraska. And then UNLV had been working on Jackson Arnold from Oklahoma and Auburn, a former number 10 quarterback recruit in his class. They got him. So they announced that this morning. So Jackson Arnold will come in. I think he has probably the lead as the starter. Alex Orji, if he's around, and I think he's going to be, he's got a chance at the job. Certainly it's a good duo. They've got promising young guys in the program. And Derek Garcia, who's coming in as a freshman, and Sebastian Circo, who was here. He'll be a redshirt freshman if he chooses to stay around. By the way, Calandria to Nebraska. The other quarterback on the roster, Gael Ochoa to Rice. And then, of course, Cam Friel used up his eligibility. I'm sure has 19 degrees. He took advantage of a really nice kid there. All right, more college football coming up. Let's talk to Michael Felder. We're going to get into some nuts and bolts about CFP Final Four, and we'll return to that crazy Washington story with Lane Kiffin and Jed Fish and battling over Damon Williams and people getting all nasty. It's you. You're the problem, adults.
Some restrictions apply.
Cofield and Company presents Grab Bag on ESPN Las Vegas.
Cofield and Company, my favorite time of the year. I love the transfer portal. No one else does, but I really love the tournament. I think we're in a glory era of college football. Michael Felder, this is what he does, man. He played college football. He loves college football. So tell me your reaction to the tournament so far.
I think it's interesting to have Oregon, Indiana, Miami, Ole Miss, right? I think that's a very interesting thing. And shout out to my guy, Roddy Jones, who said that Miami could win it all. And I was like, you're on drugs. And guess what? They're sitting there in position to do that. So I was wrong. He was right. I don't mind saying I was wrong. I like being wrong. I like when teams prove me wrong. Indiana, same thing last week. I knew they could beat Alabama, but I mean, look, first of all, if we're in our 60s and we still have abs like Michael Irvin, let's do it. Let's do it. But Indiana did that to Alabama. And so Oregon, Alabama is going to be really interesting. And then Oregon brings out this a different sort of a defense that they have not really played before. So I think there's a lot of different things. And then obviously you throw in the Ole Miss storyline where we're talking about Ole Miss, and Ole Miss is a team with, you know, a soldier with no country, right? Like their coach is calling them and being like, you should come here. And Ole Miss is like, we're going to try to win a national championship, so don't call me. And they're doing that. And they keep getting it done. They beat a Georgia team that I thought was the most dangerous team in the tournament, as you put it. And is that what we're calling it now? Are we calling it the tournament?
I do. I reference it like the NCAA tournament. So I call it Elite Eight, Final Four. I'm sure they hate it, but for me, it's a tournament. It's going to get bigger. I love it. It's wide open. The balance now is incredible. There's all these narratives that come out of it. I mean, I think one of the top ones is, how did Indiana go to the top of the list? Like, we can talk about Fernando Mendoza and quarterback play the last couple of years, but when we talk about Indiana, we talk about physicality. Like, how did Kirk Cignetti, who's an offensive guy, turn both sides of the ball so physical that even Alabama was like, oh my God, we're a little overwhelmed?
I don't think that Alabama was prepared for a team that they didn't think was going to be that physical. And then when you meet physicality with physicality, it's like when you're the bully at school, right? And then all of a sudden, another kid punches you in the teeth and you've never been punched in the teeth like that. And you're like, hang on, this is not supposed to happen to me. And I think they did a really good job of that. And they are a physical team, but they're also so incredibly dedicated to very small things. And that's what I don't think I was trying to explain this to my wife. This team is dedicated to very small things. I was like, do you see where his hands are? Do you see where he steps? Do you see? And they're dedicated to very small things, because small things make big things happen. And the only reason, I'll be honest, the only reason I know about that is because Frank Cignetti Jr., he was my offensive coordinator in college. And so these little tiny things were things that he was preaching to our players, and we didn't always understand them. As a scout team defensive guy, and then obviously the offensive, but Kurt is getting those, he's porting them over to his players. It's just this 1 centimeter, right? Or it's just this half inch. It's that, that's all it is. And if you do it that way, you're going to win, which is why we end up with an offensive lineman as the MVP of that football game.
So what can Oregon do this time around to win it? What can Oregon bring to Indiana that maybe it couldn't bring the first time?
I think the defense that they play is amazing. But Indiana is patient. Like, you're making me think right now, Cofield. You're making me think. Muscle to muscle, I think Oregon can win. But tight to tight, I think Indiana is going to win. So here's what I look at. I think this is super important. If you can, for Oregon to win, they have to show something they've never seen. Confusion. They did it last week, right? That defense they played last week, we haven't seen that. And so you have to bring some sort of confusion to the plate to create mistakes. Because what, Finney Jr., right? How does he have a game like that? It's not because he just became an amazing player. It's because they had no idea what to do when he was also on the field with 5 other defensive backs. And so that, to me, is, I think, creating confusion. And we'll see if Dan Lanning can do it again. Dan Tosh also, I'll give Tosh some flowers as well. But you got to do something that something they have not been able to prepare for.
It's Felder.substack.com. Michael Felder, longtime college football insider. He always helps us out every week, getting you ready for the college football weekend. So the other part of this Final Four has Ole Miss, mm-hmm. and I've been saying Trinidad Chambliss, based on especially what I saw against Georgia, he might be the most dangerous guy at the quarterback position left in the tourney, which is saying a lot because the number 1 and 2 pick could be going at it. And the other one, why is Chambliss so good? What did he do to the Georgia defense that maybe he can't do against the Miami defense?
Well, I'm going to go backwards to go forwards. I think Dante Moore should be 1. Who's 2? Parson Beck?
Well, I think it's Fernando Mendoza. No?
Okay, there we go. Fernando Mendoza. Okay, I just wanted to make sure it wasn't Carson Beck.
I know you're not a Beck guy, and when I mentioned the draft, obviously Beck right now is not in great standing. I think that'll change once he goes into the draft process. But
Point is,
Chambliss looked awesome. He looked hard to restrain, and I just wonder. Super Miami's goal defense is really good.
Reuben Bain is a monster. And so when you put a monster on, let's say we put a monster on the offense's left side, the right side is like, I get to do whatever I want. Whatever I want. I can do anything. And that's what we're seeing with Miami. And Ole Miss has to figure out a way, but Ole Miss's defense stood up in a huge way. I mean, if you hit a quarterback so hard that he lines up under a guard, you might be doing things the right way. So, but I need more production from Miami. Like, do you disagree with that?
No, they have to be better this week for sure.
Because Ole Miss, they're not going to stop.
No.
And if you don't get more offensive production, I mean, what are we're looking at? Correct me if I'm wrong. Look at me. No hands, no notes. 103 from Carson Beck, and then 183. You check the numbers. Right?
Okay.
So if you're not going to be like a prolific passer, but your run game also is pretty, what do the kids say? Mid. You can't live on defense. Defense is great. It's fantastic. It's so good. Defense is steak. But every now and then, maybe you want a crab rangoon. Every now and then, you go out and get yourself. You know what I'm saying? you got to go out sometimes. Maybe you have crab legs. Like, you got to go out. I can't stick to crab, but that's what's on my mind right now. But you got to go out and do something else, something extra. You got to go out and get something special. And Miami's not bringing a lot special right now.
What do we maybe miss on Cristobal in terms of program building, aside from the recruiting? I think it's really interesting that that defensive line excels. They also have two Canes coaching them, great in Jason Taylor and Damian Lewis. And I like bringing up the fact that Warren Sapp said he didn't want to work hard enough to work for Miami and Cristobal. Like, when they put the standards in front of him, he's like, nah, no thanks. I love that they brought in former Canes, and this defensive line has talent, but it's also hitting a new level because of great coaching.
Oh, I love the coaching, and I love the players coming back. It's really cool. I do think that what we're with Cristobal, it's not development. It's not caring about his players. It's not being a part of the community. He just makes bad decisions. Like, at the end of the game, you're like, man, I don't know if I trust this guy. It's like, you know what it's like. Like, it's like your friend, when you guys, where are you going? In-N-Out, Whataburger, you're going to, in my world, Cookout, Bojangles, and your friend is the one driving, and you're like, you tell them what you want, and then they just fumble the order. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's a little more serious when you have a national championship on the line.
Right. And so it's like, but they fumble the order, and you're like, I told you I didn't want pickles. I told you I didn't want mayonnaise. What are we doing right now? And they look at you like, well, I didn't know. I like, no, you knew, because I told you. And that's been his biggest kind of bugaboo over the course of his career. It's not that he can't coach. It's not that he can't develop. It's not that he can't get kids to the next level. It's someone that is walking up to your driveway with a pizza that you ordered, and they trip over your front stoop, and you're like, what happened?
Just the finish line, man.
Like, you're so close. We could have done it. And I'll be honest. I really hope all four of these teams win a national championship. Obviously, only one can do it. But the thing for me and for each one, Cofield, I want Indiana to do it because they're in a spot they've never been in, and I want them to do it. I want Oregon to do it because I think Dan Lanning is amazing. I want Miami to do it. Prove me completely wrong. Put all the egg on my face. By the way, one of my best friends in the world. I was in his wedding. He was in my wedding. I was in his wedding. His dad dropped off. I was on doing a call, and his dad dropped off 24 eggs to me yesterday from their farm. And he was like, Felder, love you. And I want them to win. And I want Ole Miss to win, because I want them to take those eggs and put them in That's the whole point of this. I want them to put him in Lane's face.
Yeah.
So there is no loser in this for me.
Well, I'm rooting for a guy like Trinidad Chambliss because, you know, I like the transfer portal. I like opportunity. I like the fact that Chambliss moved up from Ferris State. That said, though, I do want to see Ole Miss out. And then Greg Sankey's got to try to reinvent this
tournament. Just means more. It just means more.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because I'm not going to overreact about the SEC and say it's the demise and the playing field's been even and that was just the advantage the SEC had. But that's where people are going. But I do think it's going to be really interesting for Sankey to try to push for his conference to retain more and more bids when most of us are just, what have you done for us lately? And prisoners of the moment, what's going to be his narrative to say, history says the SEC, recent history doesn't, transfer portal NIL era history doesn't say that, Greg. So now you're just lying to us. But I think he has a case, but I wonder how he's going to do it.
I mean, come on, Janet Jackson, what have you done for me lately? Ooh, yeah. And what I'm looking at is I still believe in Kirby Smart. I think that here's what I'll say. I think the Lane Kiffin LSU Ole Miss drama, I don't know which way that plays. Do you? Because if Ole Miss goes out and wins a national championship without Lane Kiffin, and Lane Kiffin is LSU's answer, well, how does that work? They're like, we could do it without you.
Right.
So I think that's interesting. But at the end of the day, for me, I just want these kids to play good football. I do. I want them to play good football. And Oregon, Dan Lanning are awesome. I think Kurt Cignetti is such a – this dude is screws. I was talking to my dad. I was talking to my dad, military guy. You know, we never called a plumber. We never called an electrician in our house. My dad was like, I'll do it. And that's where I got that from, for me. I'm not as good as him, but that's where I got it from. And that's what Indiana is. Indiana is someone they're going to fix it. And I think Indiana, to me, favorite. Then I would, if Oregon's able to beat them, I'll take Oregon. And then give me Ole Miss. And listen, I'm going to pick against Miami again. And if I get embarrassed again by Miami, let's go.
Michael Felder says, let's close on this. And I know we do a lot of the dark side of college football, but I do think we have to address the fact that Lane Kiffin is the dirtiest player in the game. He is the Ric Flair of college football coaches. And what he's pulling, and I think this is a Lane Kiffin story rather than a player story, but the story that developed with DeMond Williams in Washington, and I think eventually Washington will relent on this, but the fact that LSU just went after him regardless of the fact that he had signed what we think is a binding deal, DeMond Williams is getting crushed. But I think this is a Lane Kiffin story. I think this is a coach's story. Yeah. Do you want to put the players on this? You want to skewer them? You want to put them on the frying pan?
No, I don't.
They're adults. They make decisions. You sign a contract. Or is it the coaches who piss and moan but then lack the self-control and will play the scumbag card and go after each other?
Here's what I'm going to say. I don't know if people remember this, but Lane Kiffin, when he left Tennessee, was calling players to say don't go to class. Because if you go to class, you won't be able to enroll at USC with me. So I don't think this is a player story. I don't think this is even the coaches that are moving. I don't think it's their story. I think what we need to have, and I've been working so hard, Cofield, to write about this, and it's so hard to figure it out. But there should, just like the NFL, there should be a hiring freeze for the postseason. Shouldn't be able to. There's nothing. Agents can talk. Who cares? Right? You have an agent. Do you have an agent?
I do not know.
I have an agent. He doesn't do a lot for me, but I have one. but I also don't make him a ton of money, so it's fine. But I think schools, agents, agents can talk. Schools, hierarchy should be able to talk. But I do not think that coaches, players should be able to talk interface in that world because it does matter. Let everything settle down and then you make a decision. I think we should also move. I think the calendar is completely screwed up anyways. But, you know, Joey McGuire said the same thing. Dan Lanning has said the same thing. This should not be a second semester sport. If we're going to call them student athletes still, what are we doing playing football in the second semester?
Right. So back it all up to mid-August and have it done by, you know, the first week of January, if not earlier. And yeah. and by the way, play on Saturdays. Screw the NFL.
That's yeah. Like who? Like don't run away from it.
Yeah.
Don't run away. Play. I don't care if you play on Thursdays and Fridays. Just don't. Don't. and I'm not allowed to use profanity here, so I'm because I'm mad. But my daughter's PE coach went to Oregon, and he went to the game, and he was like, "It was amazing. It was great." But he was like, "I don't understand how we got that game." So it's
right. They have a lot of fixing to do, and people need to step up as leaders and stop sniping. And from what I hear, you know, I cover a lot of college basketball. I hear that, you know, the college basketball meetings when the coaches all get together at the NABC, like everyone mm-hmm. gripes the whole year, and then no one really talks in the meeting. And a lot of people don't show up. So, like, if you care, then show up and make changes. I think the lack of leadership. And I'm not going to go after conference commissioners necessarily because – the commissioners work at the behest of the presidents, and the presidents are working with the coaches. So this can't be – I mean, it's a difficult process to get through, but step up and, you know, Lanning and, I don't know, Calipari on the basketball side and Izzo.
Calipari's doing a really good job, I think.
Okay. Go to meetings and be active, and let's get some things done. It's like every year they make changes, and then within a month they're like, these changes aren't enough. Like, well, then why do you make more changes?
I will say this. I am someone – I'm not going to dox my kid – but I am on my child's.
Okay.
I'm not on the PTA board. They actually brought me in to do recruitment to get kids, because my kid goes to public school, which I think is important. And they literally were like, we need someone that isn't. Basically, what they said is that we need someone who's not a white lady to be on the, to be an ambassador for the school.
Okay.
And so. I have tomorrow, I'm going to go, and or I guess today when this comes out, I'm going to go and talk to a very wealthy neighborhood about why their kids should go to this public school. And they're like, we need somebody who's not, doesn't live in the neighborhood. Because listen, I can't afford to live there. But they're like, but someone who they see and that they're, and I'm just like, we just need people to like be advocates. And for these kids in college football, this is how I'm going backwards to go forwards. But for these kids in college football, they need someone who's going to step up for them. And it doesn't have to be all about money. Doesn't even have to be about a degree. It just has to be about the fact that these kids are getting experience and exposure, and it matters, and we need to make it meaningful to them instead of it being just a piece of a system, right? Like a piece of, I don't care if it's Disney, I don't care if it's CBS. Like, I work for CBS, I've worked for Disney, I've worked for Turner, like I've done all that, but this is their real life. It's their real life. You got to show them how to use football to get to where they want to be. Softball, volleyball, any of that to get to where they want to be. And I don't think we're doing that in a good way.
No.
And that's the part. And I guess I'm sorry. I feel like I'm standing on, like, you know, my soapbox. But it is very frustrating to me.
Should be. The kids are learning bad lessons. And this is it's not supposed to be just about sports. The examples being set,
Yeah.
The past being blazed, or just it's embarrassing, and everyone looking around pointing at everyone else instead of coming up with solutions. So I know your time is tight, man. I'm looking forward to these games. Should be excellent, and we'll check in with you next week before the final.
Sounds good, big dog.
Michael Felder, our college football insider at In the Bleachers, up on Twitter, does Learfield podcast, getting us ready for the CFP semifinals. We are headed towards another edition of the Josh Pastner Radio Show, live from New Orleans inside Bailiwick.